Hey guys, and welcome to another Rewind. I've currently been working on my next comedy album, so I've been caught up with that. But don't worry, I'll make it up to you as soon as everything gets done, and we'll get back to some more scary stories. But for now, enjoy these.
Rude Dad.
I was having a smoke with my dad in the bathroom. We have an exhaust fan in there, middle of the winter in Saskatchewan, and I'm not going outside. I get up to go and get a glass of water, then go sit in the living room. Our house is pretty small and open, so I can very clearly see the bathroom door from where I'm sitting. My dad walks out of the bathroom and looks at me. I say, "Hey, what do you want me to make for supper?" Doesn't say anything. Just looks at me and then walks away and enters his bedroom, where I can very clearly hear him start knocking things around. I say again, "Hey, that's pretty rude, I'm talking to you." Sound stop. My dad comes out of the bathroom and says to me, "What are you yelling about? Who did I just make eye contact with, talk to, and then watch walk into my dad's bedroom?"
Something's wrong.
In the early 2000s, my family was living in Europe, and in December of 2001, we were coming back home to Latin America for Christmas vacation. My brother and I, both in high school at the time, and my dad were flying together from Paris to Miami. My dad was seated in business class, while my brother and I were in coach, sitting in the middle two seats of the middle row. The flight was pretty normal at first, absolutely nothing out of the ordinary. About 4 or 5 hours into the flight, I was reading a book, almost dozing off, when I heard a woman start to repeat the word "no" over and over. At first it was really quiet, almost inaudible, but it quickly got very loud and urgent. Before I realized what was happening, she was screaming, "No, no, no," at the top of her lungs. I looked up and saw a flight attendant a few rows ahead of me to the right, hunched over someone sitting on the window seat. My first thought was that a passenger was having a heart attack or some catastrophic health problem, but her yelling was so unsettling that this couldn't be it. There was a strangely long delay in people's reactions. Nobody did anything. I completely panicked and froze in my seat. My brother, on the other hand, jumped up out of his seat, jumped over the person sitting on the aisle seat to his right, and ran up to see what was going on. He was up there in a matter of seconds, and as he approached, suddenly everyone around us stood up to see what was going on and or try to help. She kept screaming, and now she was struggling with this passenger. He was really tall, so tall that his whole head was visible over the back of the seat, and he had long, curly black hair. My brother came back to our row and said, "Something is wrong," before going back up to get a closer look. Passengers close to her began struggling with the guy as well. A bunch of people jumped on him and started pulling at him, and someone in the row behind him even pulled his hair back so hard his face jerked towards the top of the plane. He let out a really loud moan slash scream, and then there was chaos. The aisles were so crowded nobody could move, and I saw a fire extinguisher being passed hand to hand from the back of the plane. I immediately thought there was a fire and they were all going to die. It was an incredibly hopeless sensation to know that there's nowhere to run or nowhere to escape in this situation unfolding right in front of you. They passed the extinguisher up to a male flight attendant near the guy, and the flight attendant hit him with the butt of the extinguisher really hard on the face. They started asking for belts, headphones, straps, etc., anything they could use to restrain him. My brother took off his belt and gave it to him, and they wrapped everything they could around the passenger's arms, shoulders, and torso, securing him to the seat. I saw the male flight attendant who had hit him with the extinguisher carry a pair of large black tennis shoes to the back of the plane, which at the time seemed kind of strange, but I didn't think too much of it. The flight attendants asked if there was a doctor on board to sedate the guy. People kept asking if there was a flight marshal on board, but nobody came forward. I can't remember exactly how or when things calmed down, but eventually everyone was told to return to their seats. A small group of people that helped restrain the guy were asked to keep guard on a rotation. There were always at least a few people sitting behind him and or next to him, keeping an eye on him. I think there was even someone behind him holding a fistful of his hair for the rest of the flight. The pilot announced over the PA that there had been a security breach. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was vague, and that we were being diverted to Boston Logan Airport. He said they didn't know if the person was working alone, so get to know your neighbor. We're in the middle of the Atlantic with maybe 4 more hours to go before we could land. Things were a bit ominous and tense, but for the most part, everyone was friendly and in a pretty good mood. Nobody knew what had actually happened. We weren't allowed to get up from our seats, and if you had to use the bathroom, you needed to call a flight attendant to escort you to the lavatory where you weren't allowed to lock the door. I remember a grumpy old Frenchman a few rows from us got really annoyed after a while and kept getting up without permission just to annoy the flight attendants. They were not happy. After a while, they put on the movie Legally Blonde to distract passengers. My brother and I went up to business class to talk to my dad. Apparently, they didn't hear the extent of the chaos back in coach, and they were all going about business as usual, pun intended. A few hours later, as we approached the US, we saw fighter jets outside of the windows on both sides of the plane. The pilot announced that they were escorting us to Boston. A few little kids got really excited watching the jets. I later learned that these are a last resort security measure to prevent hijacked planes from repeating 9/11 style attacks. They were supposed to shoot us down in case of a major threat. We landed and were told to stay seated. A SWAT team came on board carrying assault rifles and tons of body armor, cut off all the guys' restraints, and took him off of the plane. I saw everything in detail, since we were seated only a few seats behind him. We were parked in the middle of the tarmac for a long time before we were allowed to disembark. I remember seeing pieces of my brother's belt on the guy's seat as we left, and thought about taking one as a souvenir, but thought better of it. We're escorted to a baggage claim area in Boston Logan Airport that was surrounded by a large metal fence to keep us all in one place. We were there for what felt like 3 or 4 hours, just waiting anxiously, and nobody would explain anything to us. Passengers were getting really agitated, shaking the metal fences and yelling at the airport personnel that this was inhumane treatment. There was no food, nowhere to sit, and children were crying. Dozens of people were trying to sleep on the baggage carousel. They finally ordered a bunch of pizzas and led us into the waiting area with actual chairs, where each passenger was interrogated by the FBI. They were astonishingly unfriendly. I guess they were trying to discern if the guy had any partners on board. Then they shuttled us to our baggage, where security officers thoroughly hand-searched every single person's shoes, suitcases, and carry-on bags and patted everyone down. We were finally allowed to make a phone call and call my mom. The rest of the family was completely hysterical. They had been watching the news all day and knew that an extremist terrorist had tried to blow up our flight with a bomb that he had smuggled on board in his shoe. We had absolutely no idea what had really happened up until this moment, as we were kept completely in the dark. It was a very strange sensation. Up until this point, my dad, brother, and I had actually remained pretty relaxed considering the circumstances, and were more annoyed about the inconvenient changes to our travel itinerary than the crazy experience on the plane. We had no idea how bad the security breach really was, and how close we came to being killed. After about 12 hours in Boston, we were put on another flight home. My brother made the mistake of giving a few interviews to CNN and other networks while we were in Boston, so when we landed in our small country, he was immediately swarmed by the press and gave a bunch of interviews despite being exhausted. I was happy to finally sit and relax with my family after the longest and most stressful trip of my life. We later learned that the bomber, Richard Reed, had actually tried to board the same flight on the previous day. He was detained and questioned by French security because of multiple red flags. He had no luggage and purchased a one-way ticket with cash, causing him to miss his flight. They put him on the next day's flight and put him up in a hotel kind of far from the airport, since everything nearby was booked. The following day it rained, and on the walk from the hotel to the airport, his shoes got wet. This might have been why he had trouble lighting the wick in his shoe. His plan was to light it mid-flight. He waited until the passenger next to him went to the bathroom, then tried to light his shoe with matches. The female flight attendant that first engaged him had smelled the matches and was walking up and down the aisle looking for a passenger who, she assumed, was trying to smoke a cigarette. She saw him with the shoe in his lap and immediately tried to take it from him. They struggled and he bit her hand. Reed is now serving 3 life terms in prison.
The man upstairs.
This is about a decade ago and it still scares me. My great aunt lived alone in a small, 2-floor Cape house. She was one town over, and the house my grandfather had built her in the 1940s. She had a tiny spare bedroom and writing office upstairs. My great aunt was a nun and a teacher, and would often write friends, former students, and work on a book of her stories she never quite finished. My mother and I would visit from time to time to help take care of chores in and around the house as years went on. When I left for college, my mother started visiting more often. No sense in us both being alone, she told me. While I was away, my great aunt started showing signs of dementia that progressed steadily. It started with stories she'd tell us for the thousandth time, so we already knew them well. One story would start when she and my grandfather were kids, but then resolve somehow when she was an adult. Basically, she'd combine two unrelated stories into one, which would leave her confused. She also started forgetting to eat, taking her meds, and would crank the heat in the summer to the point where she'd be dehydrated. Some days were worse than others. So when I finished college, we started visiting nearly daily as she absolutely refused to go into assisted living. We set up Meals on Wheels and asked some of her friends and former neighbors to come by, so we weren't the only ones visiting. My mother and I convinced her to start writing in the kitchen rather than upstairs to prevent a fall on the steps. Without a reason to go upstairs, we shut off the old second floor heaters and closed the overpainted squeaky doors to the floor. We find the door cracked often, but my great aunt insisted she didn't go up there anymore. We weren't the only ones stopping by, so maybe someone fetched something upstairs and forgot to close it. Again, my great aunt was a nun, and around the holidays, she'd roll out the more religious stories and talk about God a lot. One day when I was visiting her alone, she started reflecting on her life, mortality, and when the man upstairs is going to come for her. I changed the subject, as it's uncomfortable. But over time, she started talking more about when she'd die. It's gonna come for me soon. I don't know when the man upstairs will do it, though. Trying to reassure her, "Auntie, I'm sure you have many years left. God isn't coming to take you anytime soon." With the most serious expression I've ever seen on her sweet old face, she said, "No. Not God, the man upstairs." At around this point in time, she started seeing things like flashes or spiders that weren't there, or a little boy in her living room that only she could see, even when my mom and I were visiting. I chalked this up to dementia. Later that week, snow fell, so after shoveling myself out early, I went to my great aunt's to shovel her walkway for my mom, who'd visit her later. After shoveling, I called my mom so she'd know the shoveling was taken care of. I also said I wasn't coming in as I had to go to work, and she thanked me. I drove off and noticed I had forgotten my rock salt I had used on the walkway, so quickly circled the block and picked it up. As I was reaching for it, I saw something out of the corner of my eye. The second floor light in the old writing office had turned on. I glanced quickly, then pretended I didn't see it. I got in my car and went down the road a short way, confirming in my mirrors it was on. I called my mom. "Can you call Auntie and see if she has any company over? Don't say I asked, and let me know how long it takes for her to pick up." My mom called back almost immediately. "No, she doesn't have company over, not this early," and she picked up right away. "Mom," I said, "you need to call the police. The light upstairs turned on after I talked to her. There's no way a 95-year-old woman hung up, hustled upstairs, then back down to pick up your call." There was no phone hooked up on the second floor. As my mom called the police, I called my aunt. "Hi, Auntie. I almost forgot. You have a doctor's appointment today. I'll come pick you up. We can grab a hot chocolate before we head over." I parked my car in front of the house and acted as normally as I could. It felt like an eternity helping her get her house coat on and out the door. As I turned the lock, I heard footsteps above us in the second floor room where I saw the light on. I helped her into my car, never looking at the house, too scared of what I'd see in that window. We went down the road a bit and I called my mom. She was already on her way over and said the police would be by shortly. I told her where I parked. She arrived there and the police weren't far behind her. I flagged down the cop before he got closer and told him what I saw and heard. He radioed for two more cars. My mom stayed with our great aunt to keep her calm as police surrounded her house. I gave them the keys to the doors and the two went in as the third cop and I stayed outside. After a few tense minutes, the two officers returned with a disheveled, gaunt man in handcuffs. "Oh, the man upstairs," my aunt said to my mother, onlooking as they fought the crazed man into the back of one of the cruisers. My great aunt had apparently let this disturbed homeless man in, thinking he was Meals on Wheels. He had secretly been living upstairs as my great aunt was confused if he was even real. When we were allowed back in, we saw that the upstairs was a mess. Garbage, rotting food, stolen from the kitchen. The amount of filth was scary. The creepiest things were the notes, written many, maybe hundreds of times in different inks and pencil scrawlings around the writing office, were notes that said, "Go away, don't stay, I'll come down." The back of the door to the stairs had notes too. "She can see me, but you don't, and I can see you." It was clear he had probably wrote the notes each time someone visited over weeks and possibly months. My great aunt was temporarily shocked, but it was quickly forgotten given her condition, and she would ask about the man upstairs less and less. The homeless man, who was in poor physical and mental health himself, was hospitalized and passed after a few weeks later into the winter. He had escaped the hospital, but his body was found the day after. He died having succumbed to the cold and exposure. My mom and I told Auntie a couple of weeks later when we found out. Oh, I know. He told me last night. He's upstairs again, but you can't see him now. At just that instant, my mom and I heard the door to the stairs squeak open.
Part 3.
So what happened when you got home, I hear you ask? Well, for a while, very little. I was kept in the hospital for about 3 weeks. The new psychiatrist seemed swamped with work and saw I wasn't really a danger to myself or others, so I was discharged. I tried finding Benoit as soon as I could, but he had gone off the grid, as they might say these days. But in truth, disappearing back then was as simple as not listing your name in the phone book. Despite living in the guy's pocket for 8 months of my life, I knew very little about him. I knew he was from a couple hours west of New Orleans, and he had a sister named Marie. Not exactly solid facts to track a man down by. Soon I gave up trying. I just decided to try and forget about everything. Vietnam, the tunnel, the woman's voice. But the statue was always there as a constant reminder. I kept it wrapped in a cloth, afraid to touch the damn thing. Eventually, I did what every other person in New York did with something they wanted to get rid of. I threw it in the East River. It would find good company down there with all the discarded mob weapons and photos of ex-girlfriends. I had a small amount of money coming in from my veteran disability payments. I topped this up by working odd jobs when I could find the work, that is. New York in 1969 wasn't exactly a fun place to be. The city stank from uncollected garbage, and there seemed to be a strike or a riot every day. The teachers, the sanitation workers. Hell, it got so bad even the gays started rioting, and they always seemed a peaceful bunch to me. I lived down near Greenwich Village, so I was right in the middle of the mess. Crime was also a huge problem. I rarely left the apartment without my pistol. And that's how it went for about 6 months. I worked a little and tried to avoid getting shot or stabbed. Then one night, out of the blue, the phone rang. I generally only got calls from cold call companies. It was a relatively new thing back then, and every asshole outfit with a phone was just trying to sell their crap. I picked up the phone. I don't want to buy radiators, life insurance, or mortgage protection, so go screw yourself, I calmly said. There was a tiny pause. It's Philippe. Philippe Benoit. I see you haven't lost your way with words, came the response. Benoit? Jesus! I tried tracking you down when I got back from Vietnam. I couldn't find a trace of you. Where the hell you been? New Orleans. Look, I don't want to say too much over the phone, but I received a very strange package in the mail. Turns out someone was able to track me down. My heart sank with the news. I didn't need to ask what was in the package. I could guess. Can you come down to New Orleans? I could offer you work and a place to crash if you need it. Do you have anything pressing keeping you in New York? I looked out the window as I listened to Benoit on the phone. Two NYPD officers were beating the ever-loving hell out of some guy with batons. A small group nearby were raining bottles at them. I replied, yeah, I could do with getting out of New York for a while. I could be there in a few days. Benoit filled me in on the details of where to meet. He didn't want to talk on the phone, as if he thought someone might be listening. The next morning, I threw what little possessions I had in my old beaten-up Impala and hit the road. I didn't bother giving notice to the landlord of my flea-bag apartment. You might think me mad for taking the trip to New Orleans. I suppose I could have just hung up the phone and forgot about Benoit and the things we saw. But that's just not me. He needed my help. We had been through hell together in Vietnam. And I don't mean that figuratively. I meant, I felt we literally descended into some kind of hell in that tunnel. I wasn't about to leave the guy to deal with this alone. It felt good to get out of New York. The journey was long and the summer was sweltering. I drove relentlessly, wanting to get to New Orleans as quickly as possible. I avoided the big cities and only stopped to sleep. On the last night of the journey, I stopped at a cheap motel near a one-horse town about an hour past Birmingham. The reception building was small. The desk was manned by a middle-aged man. I guess he was the owner on account of there being a photo of him in uniform as a younger man on the wall. It looked like it was taken somewhere in Europe during the Second World War. You look a little worse for wear. Long journey? Where are you headed to? The owner made small talk as he handed me my key. I lied as I fumbled with my things. Houston. I'm not fully sure why I lied. It's not like whoever these people with the statues were could manage to staff every hotel between New York and New Orleans with staff and on the off chance that I passed through. I was so exhausted that night, I fell asleep fully clothed as my head hit the pillow. I awoke in a sweat to the whispers of a woman. It was still night out. I took my pistol from my bag and tucked it into the back of my jeans. I left the room and followed the voice.
the same phrase over and over. "Defiler, come to the red house." I walked down the steps to ground level. The voice became louder as I approached a soda machine at the corner of the motel. A light on top glowed red in the night. "Defiler," almost like it was in my head.
"I'm not a defiler," I mumbled back to no one.
"What was that, honey? You want to defile me? Well, that's going to cost you. Usually my cusses don't put it in that kind of eloquent language," she laughed. "It was a whore. A well-dressed one at that. A little too well-dressed and refined for this motel." She was leaning near the illuminated soda machine. I replied, sorry, I was just talking to myself. The whispers had stopped. She casually inquired, "You looking for a date?" I quickly responded, "No, I'm fine, thanks. Just came to get a soda." "You sure? It's a long way to New Orleans, and I could help you relax," she said, licking her lips. My mind froze with fear, but I kept my composure. I calmly responded, "I'm headed to Houston." She dryly retorted, "Funny, the owner said you're on your way to New Orleans." I replied, matching her tone, "Well, the owner's mistaken." "That's what I told him when he said you were headed to Houston. Took some of my charm to persuade him, but he finally told me you had a map that showed a route to New Orleans when you checked in." I said nothing in response. Sadly, what he couldn't tell me was where you were headed once you got to New Orleans. "Yeah, well, maybe your charm isn't as persuasive as you think," I responded, all the while I was considering taking out my pistol and putting it to her head. She tilted her head forward a little. Her face glowed a fiery red under the light of the soda machine. She bared her teeth, and her eyes took on the same look of fanatic rage I had seen in the psychiatrist's eyes at the hospital. She spat with unrestrained rage. "Oh, you have no idea how persuasive I can be." I reached for my pistol, but she slipped around the corner and ran into the black of night. She said, laughing from somewhere deep in the darkness, "I hope you find whatever it is you're looking for." Running out after her into the night would be a fool's errand. I ran in a panic to the motel reception building. Maybe she had divulged some tiny piece of information to the owner. I could be persuasive too. Broken ribs usually jogged people's memory. Maybe he wouldn't have any information, but either way, I was going to sternly educate him on the perils of spilling your guts to strange women who offer free blowjobs. The small reception building was dimly lit. There was no one behind the desk. I rang the bell but got no response. Impatiently, I walked behind the counter. I opened the back office door. As I opened the door, the metallic smell of fresh blood hit my nostrils. I covered my nose. The owner lay dead on his back. His mouth was duct taped shut. Two glass shards had been rammed into his eye sockets. Tough bastard. I didn't give him enough credit. He wasn't falling for her hooker routine, so she had to torture him for what little information he had. Or maybe it was just to send me a message. I wasn't hanging around for the cops. Maybe this was a setup. Either way, I wasn't sticking around. I wiped down the office doorknob with my sleeve. My fingerprints being anywhere else in the building could be explained, but not on the back office door. I walked to my room with as much outward calm as I could muster. I packed my things, got my car. I drove out into the night. With luck, I'd make it to New Orleans by the morning. I knew one thing for certain. These people, whoever they were, wanted that voice to keep whispering to me. They wanted to know where it was leading me. That was the only reason I was still alive. As soon as they figured that it might be less trouble to torture me rather than just follow me, I'd end up like the owner of the motel. The pistol was digging into my back, so I took it from my jeans and opened the glove compartment to put it inside. As a glove compartment opened, a small clay statuette fell out. I didn't need to look at it. I already knew what it was. I put the pistol away and kept driving. Safety in numbers, I thought, as I sped toward New Orleans. Benoit would have a plan. He always did.
Ben.
I don't know where to start, but I suppose I should just begin here. First off, I'm not putting any names out there, nor will I give the name of the school, but let's just say it was about a good 20 years ago. I was in love, or should I say, like, with him. I knew he felt the same. The way he smiled at me in class, he was so shy. He had just started going to our school his 9th grade year. His friend, who I'll call H, on the other hand, I did not like too much. He spewed very hateful remarks and listened to anti-Semitic music. He would even bump into the jocks on purpose and hated them with a vengeance. H really pissed me off. When I would walk up, I noticed he would smile and look down at first. I pretty much ignored H because I didn't trust him. He slept with one of my friends and totally used her. He led her on for a long time. She thought they were going to be serious. He even called her a bitch behind her back. That guy always left a bad taste in my mouth. I was always polite to him because he was hanging around with Ben, so I had no choice. I loved the way Ben's sandy blonde hair would hang over his eyes. Even the way his blonde goatee that was just trying to grow in was sort of cute to me. There would usually be a big group of us rowdy teens hanging out during lunch and between breaks. I spent some time with that particular group joking and laughing. I remember the good times. We weren't the popular kids, just a bunch of geeks and nerds who loved computers. I loved the fact that we were both in the same class and would sit across from each other. I remember him always writing and doodling in his notebook. I saw one heart he drew with the first initial of my name on it, but it was quickly scratched out. I don't think he wanted me to know, but I happened to see him draw it. We'd been flirting back and forth for a few days that week. I would tell him how talented he was and how I wanted him to draw me something. He was always drawing in class. Ben took note of this and by the end of the day put a drawing of a bleeding rose with thorns in my locker. It was hauntingly beautiful. The side of him I knew was nothing like the side I witnessed that horrible day. He seemed to be depressed and not very confident of himself, a bit socially withdrawn. For some reason, he took a liking to me. I'd always compliment him and tell him I liked his band t-shirt, whichever one he would be wearing that day. He had a habit of kissing me on the top of my head and embracing me in a hug when I would walk up. I was pretty short in high school and he would even pick me up and tell me I was lightweight. He was tall for his age. He always smelled pretty good. I'd tell him that too and he would just shrug and look down. "Thanks," he'd say. I don't know if he really knew how to accept a compliment. One thing that disturbed me a little was his paper on Charles Manson. It was a very informative paper and he wanted me in particular to read it. He was very concerned about what I thought. For some reason, my opinion meant a lot to him. It had some spelling errors, but the paper itself was interesting. I wasn't really into cults, but Ben seemed to love the darker side of man. He did a lot of research and got a pretty good grade on the paper. I didn't really think it was unusual for him to write that paper. I took it with a grain of salt because quite a few boys in our grade were into serial killers as well. That particular group was. We did a few reports together in class a few times. He even loaned me one of his Rammstein CDs and told me to give it a listen. I didn't really understand the lyrics because they were in German, but the music itself had a good beat. One day, a group of friends and I went to the local pizza parlor where he happened to be working. Ben let me wear his baseball cap. I put it on frontwards and he quickly took it off and turned it around backwards. "There, it looks cuter that way," he said as I blushed. He went through a few hats, but the letter on it remained the same. I think he mentioned he switched the hats out, but always would reattach the symbol. He gave me one of his old hats. I still have it. The faded outline of the symbol is still there. He sure did love baseball. Our friendship and flirtation faded out over time. Ben seemed more withdrawn from society, and he was always with H. He followed H around like a lost puppy. He wore sunglasses during the day and began to change from the sweet, nice Ben I knew to a person I didn't recognize. He even started to dress a bit different. H and Ben even started getting into trouble a bit at school. There was this one locker incident that happened, but I'd rather not go into detail about it here. One day, I had missed school and I asked him if I could copy down the homework assignment instructions from his day planner. The project was due next week, and I wanted to know exactly what was required. I wanted to get my grade and not get any points knocked off. I knew he had poems and sayings in the planner. "The lonely man strikes with absolute rage," was scrawled in black ink. I will never forget that particular one. It was a bit disturbing to me after I gave it some thought. Unfortunately, I would experience firsthand what his absolute rage was all about. The most terrifying day of my life.
Burrito.
I had a near-death experience. I went to sleep after drinking some beers and making a chorizo burrito. What I remember is being surrounded by light in every direction. I wasn't awake and it wasn't a dream. All I could feel was peace, warmth, and serenity. It felt like forever, but also it felt like only 1 second. Something forced me to wake up, and when I came to, my first thought was, that was Grandma. She is the most recent past family member in the family. I went into the kitchen to get some water, and I heard a noise. The burner on the stove was on low. I realized that I had left it on in my drunken stupor. I must have been dying from CO2 poisoning.
Don't let them in.
Maybe if I'd paid closer attention, I could have stopped this. Whatever this is, or at least my role in it. As I'm writing this out, I can still hear it every half an hour, like clockwork, always ending with the same refrain. No matter who is at the door, do not let them in. I first knew I wanted to be an actress when I was 3, the first time I stepped on stage. A gold foil crown resting on my head, crafted from yogurt lids and wrapping paper. A jar of what was supposed to be myrrh in my right hand, and an oversized cane in my left. I don't actually think I had any lines, but I can remember my parents beaming. My parents and everyone else beaming. I knew I had to be an actress when Evan Palmer said that I was the prettiest girl in school after I played Beatrice in our school's production of Much Ado About Nothing. The nerves had made me throw up the night before. I'd been tempted to call in and tell the school I was sick, and tell them that they had to get another one of the girls to do it. Maybe Mary Percival, who knew all my lines anyway because she spent every night the past week rehearsing it with me. And then I started thinking that actually Mary might be very good, and that maybe for the interest of not only myself, but everyone else in the play, I should actually, genuinely, call in sick. But I didn't call. I didn't call in sick, and I remembered every line. When Evan told me, I thought I was going to be sick all over again. But I wasn't. I knew what I'd done on stage had made him say this. I was suddenly aware of the power I had that night. For a while, I sat smiling and thinking about every little detail I'd put in my performance, and whether or not the crowd had picked up on it. Of course, my accident changed all that. I've been told to call it my accident, to take ownership of the event, and to stop it from feeling as though it is something that I can't control now. My parents and friends tried their hardest to convince me that I could still act, and that I was still beautiful, but I could see it in their eyes that, bless them, they didn't really believe it. So I made excuses about becoming more interested in writing, to spare them the secondhand embarrassment of watching me, post-accident, walk on a stage and watch as every member of the crowd winced in unison. And so, I stopped acting for a long time. I didn't go outside much. I must have read hundreds of books, but all the girls in them were beautiful, even when they weren't supposed to know that they were. I watched a lot of TV, and preferred animated shows. I felt that they weren't real, and I was less conscious of the difference between us, and I wasn't so conscious about what had happened to my face. It was through this that I discovered voice acting, and I felt like I had been offered another chance. I felt back in control. I bought a $100 microphone and a home recording setup, recorded a few monologues from my favorite shows and plays, and posted them online. I built up a small portfolio, and every now and again would receive an offer or request. Often the request would barely pay anything, but I received a small amount from the settlement every month, and had no real cost except for food and internet. These smaller jobs began to accumulate, and before long, I had a decent portfolio and returning customers. I was in a few small web shows, some that you might have seen. Still, these gigs don't pay much, and I was living in a tiny apartment on the edge of town, eating instant ramen and drinking cheap beer. But at least I had some control. I felt real again, as if what my accident had robbed from me, I had reclaimed. I had colleagues, a network of people who trusted and respected me. It was only a few days ago that I received a small notification on one of the freelance sites I used. A standard username and a fairly standard request, although the sum of the money was way larger than I was used to. I took a screenshot and sent it over to a voice actor friend of mine. It was an ad in the local section of one of these websites that the poster had sent directly to me. The ad itself was vague. It specified that it was an hour or so drive out of town that I lived in and that they required a woman's voice. That was it. My friend's response was encouraging. They said that often some of the larger studios will trawl freelance sites when asked to look for new talent. The end introducing credit is growing increasingly fashionable. And often, those who are trawling will offer what they believe to be industry rates, not realizing that their figure is actually way higher than reality. I needed the money. Whilst the circumstances around the ad were unusual, the money promise would solve a lot of problems. Even with that sum of money, I could relocate to an apartment not surrounded by drunks. The message attached to the ad read, "Hi,
We're huge fans of your work and would love for you to come in for a couple of days this week. Best. I replied, Hi, great to know you guys are fans. Thanks so much. More than happy to come in for a couple of days this week. But where exactly? Is transport paid for? Furthermore, do you have any character notes or would you like a demo of any type of performance you might want? Sorry for all the questions. It might be easier if we call. Thanks again. Their response. No call. Character notes not applicable. Rate specified includes petrol. I lived in a small town with a relatively small population. However, it's a well-known fact that in the Scottish Highlands surrounding my town, there are dozens and dozens of military bases. These range from the official, where training exercises are run and truckloads of troops will stop off at a local pub for a drink, to the unofficial, plots of land that don't appear on satellite images and reports of strange activity that slowly filters through the gossip mill. It looked like the location was fairly close to one of these bases, down a road I've driven a few times. The road itself was long and winding. It cut into a shallow valley and was filled with so many twists and turns that it had earned a place for itself in local mythology. There were always accidents when there was frost, and the locals managed to conjure up all sorts of reasons for these. I thought it was fairly evident that frost and hairpin turns don't make for easy driving, but I had heard everything from aliens to ghosts trapped in the valley, and so I agreed to the job. I spent the morning before practicing vocal warm-ups and working out my route there. The drive there was uneventful. Thankfully, I downloaded the map and printed it off, as reception soon grew faulty. I went up a slow incline and then down into the valley. I could just make out a white dot in the distance, and as I grew closer, I realized there was some sort of cottage. It would make sense for some indie studio to record in a cottage, although something about it was a little unsettling. The white coat of paint seemed brand new, unchipped, and the gravel on the drive was from a stone I hadn't seen before, a shade of brown that wasn't present in the Highlands. The man who opened the door wasn't quite what I expected. Something about him seemed familiar, as if I met him before, and when he shook my hand, I caught a twang in his voice that I half recognized, but this is probably mistaken. He stank of expensive clothing sprayed liberally and wore sunglasses despite the overcast sky. He told me that they were excited to have me here, that they couldn't wait for me to sink my teeth into what they had planned, using the phrase, role of a lifetime. He gave a nod to the receptionist who was typing away at her computer as we walked past, although she didn't look up. He took me down into the basement, which had been kitted out with bright LED lights and gray soundproofing foam, where he handed me a set of legal documents. He mentioned something about finding a colleague and left the room. I read the first few lines, and the last, and the thickness of the set of papers I'd been handed indicated to me that even they didn't expect me to read it all. Nothing in the document seemed out of the blue, and I signed where indicated. It took me a moment to get my bearings, and I noticed that the basement of this building seemed bigger than I initially thought. The small room I was in was connected to a door that seemed to be the recording booth and three other doorways. Two were shut, and through the one that was open I could just make out a long corridor. As I stood to take a look, the man came back, and he escorted me into the recording booth. I realized that I didn't know his name. He hadn't asked mine when we met, and he moved straight into the business talk that I missed my opportunity. He looked at me as he closed the door and asked if I wanted anything. I was tempted to ask then, to apologize for forgetting earlier, but there was something in his manner that stopped me. A woman's voice came on over the intercom. Thank you so much for coming. In front of you is a short script. We'll only be reading this today. I looked at the script in front of me and picked it up. Judging from its weight, it was only a dozen or so pages. I squinted at the cover page and ran a thumb over the all caps title, Alert. That was all it said. I turned over the first page and looked to the margins to see which characters were speaking, but nothing. Instead, the pages were filled with paragraphs and paragraphs of double-spaced type. I looked back up, confused. I could hear a faint buzzing coming from somewhere outside the room. Is this it? Are there any character notes? Any cues that I should be aware of? We only need you to read what's in front of you. Stay calm. I assumed the stay calm was some sort of stage direction, but I couldn't be sure. I did feel myself starting to panic slightly, and I thought about how little I knew about where I was. I didn't tell anyone where I'd be, because I had no one to tell. The script I read was delirious and rambling. It made no sense. It was compiled with contradiction upon contradiction. Characters seemed to be in two places at once, and often I would have monologues that would seem to be spoken by different people at the same time, covering places local to me in vague terms, with odd biblical turns of phrase, with sections that sounded like invocations and repeated words. I didn't know what this was for, but it couldn't be usable. It didn't make enough sense. You never know with freelance work, though. Often the best paychecks come from vanity projects, and so I plowed on. The script grew increasingly esoteric and strange, quoting Freud and Crowley, Desaad and Newton and Yeats. It made me a little uncomfortable, if I'm honest. Those who've listened to any of Charles Manson's speeches after he was arrested or read some sort of lunatic's manifesto will know how unnerving genuine madness really is. And this felt something like that. It was just beginning to grow to a fever pitch when I was cut off. That'll be all for today. You'll be escorted from the premises now. Same time tomorrow. Escorted from the premises? I frowned. That wasn't something you'd say to an actor, and definitely not one who you picked up from a local ad online. I heard the sound of a door open and the clip-clip of heels down the corridor. Realizing this might be the woman, I dashed to the door and opened it. Unfortunately, she was already a long way down the corridor opposite and moving quickly. Regardless of how weird the experience was, I didn't want to embarrass myself by dashing down after her. And even then, what would I say? Would I tell her that the script had made me uncomfortable? That the term escorted from the premises seems too strong? It all seemed ridiculous, and instead, I just watched her walk away. I was a little disappointed with her silhouette, if I'm honest. The disembodied voice had meant I'd expected her to look a whole lot wilder, and I was disappointed with the fact that from behind, she seemed to look perfectly normal. She was about my height and had dark hair. The same way that you expect celebrities to be taller, I expected her to have an impossible hourglass figure and a sheer black bob, but no, she seemed to be just like me. When I think back over this day, I feel that maybe this was more important than I give it credit for, but I'm still not sure how, like an itch you can't scratch. The man came back downstairs and noticed me watching the woman. He moved to the door quicker than I'd seen him move before, quicker than the relaxed persona, sunglasses, and cologne would suggest he could, and he slammed it shut. Follow me. My mind wandered as I climbed the stairs and left the building. Something about it had put me on edge, and I was trying to place what it was. It hadn't been entirely unpleasant, and only a little uncomfortable towards the end, and it wasn't as if I found the woman's voice or the man threatening. I sat in my car for a while thinking, without turning the engine on, listening to the rhythmic sound of rain beginning to fall, the tap-tap-tap growing harder and more regular as my windshield became covered in tiny rivulets. What had made me so uncomfortable slowly dawned on me. The whole place had felt fake, like a film set or an empty stage. It wasn't lived in. There was no wear and tear, and everything from the chair I sat on to the door I had come in through had seemed brand new and factory fresh, as if just moments before I arrived, they'd been pulling the shrink wrap off.
Part 2.
As I mulled this over, I drove slowly back up towards the town. The rain was falling heavily now, and I had to put the fog lights on to cut through the half light of the evening. There was no one else for miles around, and the wild grass and shrubs of the highlands stretched on and on in every direction around me. Something, maybe thunder, boomed in the distance. I kept driving, checking my rearview to see my own face looking back at me. My eyes and the ugly scar that ran from my brow to my chin, dividing my face into two mismatched halves. That sound again, except it was closer. It sounded less like thunder. I looked at my wing mirrors, a little frightened now, and made out nothing behind me. I'd have seen it if there was, at least that's what I told myself. I didn't want to go too much faster, and I admit to myself that something was wrong, but I increased my speed slightly and checked my wing mirrors more and more often. That sound again. I'd been wrong the first time. It wasn't thunder at all. It was a low, rumbling sound, but it was much closer. I increased my speed a little more. I checked my rearview mirror, and for a second, I thought I could make out a pale flash amongst the gray shrubbery, like a body. Someone, something running across the grass and up the shallow valley, running towards me, and then it disappeared, as if it had thrown itself to the ground, and I couldn't help but floor the pedal and drive as fast as I could away. Tires shrieking in the rain, drenched in sweat and clutching the steering wheel so tight the tips of my fingers tingled. I didn't sleep well that night. For a while, I found comfort in the sounds of the drunks outside my window, shouting as they stumbled up and down the street. I could make out the voice of Pete, the way his S's whistled due to his missing teeth, and the sound of Charlie belch, and hear Tommy shout in his thick accent as he stumbled into the bins on account of his milky eyes, ruined by age, like marbles covered in PVA glue. But around 1 or 2 a.m., they stopped altogether. Usually they continued until the early hours, but that night they stopped simultaneously. Instead of fading out one by one, the noise stopped at once. I heard the sound of their footsteps get fainter and was surprised at the speed they all moved away at. If I didn't know better, I'd have thought that they were running away. I woke up in the morning exhausted and wasn't entirely sure when I'd fallen asleep. It felt as if I'd only closed my eyes for a second, but there was daylight poking through my curtains. I checked my watch. Damn, my second visit was in 15 minutes' time. I'm not even sure I had time to think about last night's events as I rushed through my morning routine, brushing my teeth as I got dressed, blasting myself with deodorant, necking scalding coffee as I threw my phone charger in the bag. I drove as quick as I could, and the light of new day, the landscape that had put me on edge last night, seemed to have dissolved with the night. As I pulled into the cottage, I noticed a few figures in the distance. They were easy to spot as they were all wearing high-V jackets, which stood out against the muted colors of the grass and mountains. I looked closer. They were wearing high-V jackets and carrying something big. And the man from yesterday opened the door and saw me looking at the high-Vs. Well, I assume he did at least, but his sunglasses still covered half his face. Hey, let's not waste time. In. Of course, I was late. Again, there was something familiar in his voice, an accent I knew. But I had no time to puzzle it over as I was shepherded inside. I hurried in, nodded to the receptionist, and walked down the stairs towards the studio. The door was already open for me today, and a new script was on the table. The woman made me spend a while perfecting my tone of voice. Apparently, I sounded too stressed. Perhaps it was because I was running late and had time to do any of the vocal warm-ups I usually do. The second day's script was stranger. They had me reading all sorts of strange alerts and broadcast as slowly and calmly as possible. It was a jarring change from the previous day ramblings, and the two recordings seemed so at odds with each other, I wasn't sure that they could be for the same project. I had no idea what this could be. I thought, perhaps I was providing a voiceover for a viral marketing campaign, or for a top secret portion of a popular show or movie series. But I knew in my heart that both of these options weren't true, and there was something just too strange about the whole thing. There was much less to read today. And instead the woman was focused on ensuring that my voice was consistently relaxed and calming. About an hour in, there was a commotion outside. I heard several voices outside my door and the sound of her heels clipping down the corridor quickly as if she was in a rush to attend to something. I opened the door just a crack and saw the man who let me in hurry down a corridor to my right, evidently following the source of the noise and commotion. Slowly, opening the door inch by inch, I moved out into the room at the bottom of the stairs. I approached the corridor the woman had marched down and watched it for a while. I could hear the voices get fainter and fainter, echoing from far away. With my heart in my mouth, I decided to move a little further into the corridor. Although the voices were faint now, I could still hear them, and I knew that if they were to come back this way, I'd be able to hear it. So, making sure not to make any noises, I started walking. I thought perhaps the underground section had been a studio. But as I walked further, I realized that it was far, far bigger. The map in my head had three corridors that maybe had several rooms for equipment and editing, but this was on another scale entirely. The corridor I was walking down had dozens of corridors branching off of it, and each of these seemed to stretch out for hundreds of meters, intersected by other corridors that I could only assume stretched just as far, if not further, their dirty cream wallpaper blanketed in sterile white light. Whatever this was, underground, spread out like a web or a fungus in every direction? Part of me tried to rationalize this. Perhaps this was an old boarding school, although the hallways looked too clinical, or an old wing of a hospital. But why have a hospital this far out in the middle of nowhere? Or simply a large studio filled with room after room after room? I heard the voices grow louder and stopped in my tracks. They were coming back this way, and fast. Trying to make as little noise as possible, I retraced my steps and hurried back into the recording room. The session took another hour or so to finish, take after excruciating take. It's beyond agonizing to be told for the 12th time that your voice isn't quite soothing enough, and rallying yourself to keep it soothing whilst under that much stress is tough. There was one phrase in particular they had me repeat over and over again, until they must have had about 100 takes. They buzzed me out the same as before, but this time I heard the woman's heels ascending the stairs, and as I exited, I thought I'd catch sight of her, but instead, I only saw her legs and torso. She turned at the sound of the door opening to face me, her face obscured by view from the low ceiling above me. She stood this way, facing me but not seeing me, for a while, before continuing upstairs. I followed her. I was done with this place, with their agonizing demands and strange architecture. I tried to catch the receptionist's eyes as I left, but she was typing away, focused on the screen in front of her. The evening was darker than yesterday, and I realized that I'd been below ground for far longer than I anticipated. Again, when I sat in the car, I took a moment to think over the previous few hours. I thought about the long, seemingly endless web of corridors underground and what the doors that punctuated them held. I thought about how new the cottage seemed, and the high V jackets in the distance. I thought about the whole thing seemed like an empty stage, and the way the man who let me in seemed to be playing a part, and how I couldn't see his eyes, and how the receptionist was typing even though her screen was black and... Even though her screen was black? I shook the thought from my head. Right now I needed to focus on getting home. The experience of the previous day still had me shaken, and as I drove I used the breathing exercises they taught me in therapy. I tried to exclusively focus on driving and breathing, and counted each breath in and each breath out. For a while, it worked. The evening grew darker. Then there was the sound again, a low boom, close. I checked the rearview mirror. This time, there weren't many clouds in the sky at all. There was no way this could be thunder. The clouds seemed to be leaving the sky and rolling in off the lips of the valley, like dry ice, slowly moving towards me. It was drizzling now, and my wipers started, occasionally moving back and forth with a quiet squeak. This is all I could hear for a while, watching the fog grow closer, trying to find a station on the radio, but only coming across static until I heard that noise like thunder. The sound was back, louder than ever, and the car shuddered. I slammed on the brakes and sat for a moment in silence. I didn't move, and all I could hear was the sound of my ragged breathing, shaken and uneven. It was like I hit something with my car, maybe a rabbit or a bird. I thought about getting out and checking, but something, some sixth sense, kept me inside the vehicle. I checked the rearview mirror again, and this time, I'm certain I saw something. Something pale moved at the edge of the fog. I saw it for only a second before it was covered by the mist and the dark. Then I saw it again, closer this time, moving unnaturally, taking jagged steps before throwing itself down onto the ground. I put my foot on the gas, and I felt a lump form in my throat as the car stalled for a second, then started, the engine straining under my demands. The car sped up, but the road I was on seemed to go on forever, the distance obscured by the fog, each turn slowing me down, so that I felt like my car was on some sort of conveyor belt. I could feel beads of sweat run down my back, and every now and again, I would look in the rearview mirror to see my eyes wide and panicked and shapes moving in the fog. As they grew closer, there was a new noise, halfway between a rasp and a bark, and my hands started to shake. I prayed that the car wouldn't stop, that I wouldn't be stuck as the fog completely closed in, and all I could do was wait for them to catch up with me, and thank God it didn't. I know what I saw. I've tried to think about what they could be, tricks of light, animals seeming closer than they really were, but I know those shapes could have only been one thing. They were unmistakably bodies, human bodies. Whether or not they were people, I don't know, but the way they moved, they could only have been one thing. The thought played over and over again in my head for the rest of the drive home, and every bump in the road made me freeze for a second in fear. I parked across the road from my flat and ran to my front door, fumbling the keys in desperation to get in. I double-locked my door and took a kitchen knife into my room, where I sat with my back pressed against the wall. I didn't know what was going on yet, but something was wrong.
Part 3.
It was like a fever dream, and I felt like I only had some of the pieces of the puzzle. Try as I might to find a rational solution to all these occurrences, the tunnels, the bodies in the fog, the strange script, I couldn't. I didn't sleep again that night, and instead spent the time Googling facts about the local area. I tried to see if there were any boarding schools or hospitals nearby, but any that were or had been nearby were miles and miles away from the strange cottage. There were, however, military bases nearby, some official and on the books, and some unofficial, only locatable through secondhand accounts on conspiracy forums. The drunks started yelling and making noise a little earlier tonight, as if they were trying to dull some sense of horror from yesterday, although perhaps I was projecting. I suppose all drunks are trying to numb something in one way or another. I found their shouts comforting, I guess, in the sense that I wasn't completely alone on this street, that human contact, if I wanted it, was only a stone's throw away. Tommy's voice, his thick accent that I realized I heard earlier today, that had tried to mask itself but couldn't help giving itself away in the vowels. The accent I heard from the man who let me in the cottage. The man wearing sunglasses despite the overcast sky. The man wearing sunglasses to cover his milky eyes. It couldn't have been Tommy. He couldn't make his way from the street corner to the off-license without stumbling over once or twice, let alone making the journey out into the Highlands. Could he? Then again, like the night before, they all stopped simultaneously. Part of me wanted to run to the window and check, but I couldn't bring myself to. Instead, all I did was clutch my knife tighter, subconsciously angling it towards the street outside. Then, there was one final shout, different to the others, louder, scared, and the street was silent. The silence hung for a while, barely masked by the faint sounds of cars far away. Then I began to hear it. It was a wet, rasping sound, like the sound of someone choking. It slowly grew louder and closer, moving down the street and towards my building, towards me. I sat there, feeling sweat bead on my forehead, listening to the sound of what I realized then was breathing from outside my window. It stopped moving. That is, it stopped getting louder and closer outside my flat. It was as if whatever it was stood outside my block of flats, staring up at the window and waiting. I made the decision to take a peek to see if this was just my mind playing tricks on me or if this really was something more sinister. Slowly I edged towards the window, not pulling the curtains, but kneeling so my eyeline was level with the windowsill, and with one hand gently moving the bottom of the curtain up, I could see the low wall that covered the small terrace of the building and the bin bags by the gate, and then something pale. I pulled back, moving my hand with such speed that the curtain flew up for a moment, just enough for me to make out something in the street, something with dark eyes looking straight up at me, waiting. I moved quickly, grabbing my head and heaving it to my bedroom door, blocking myself in. I spent the rest of the night sat in a corner opposite the door, back pressed against the wall, occasionally shifting my eyes to the curtain. Whatever had seen me had grown excited, and I could hear the breathing get a little faster and a little deeper. I sat and listened for hours, turning the knife over and over in my hand. I decided that tomorrow I would go to the local library and see if I could figure out a rational solution to all of this, to put all the pieces together in a way that would explain them and make them all go away. I thought of the dark eyes outside and the face they were set in, the face that I couldn't begin to admit I recognized, a face that no one could forget. I could just picture the pale form outside, gurgling and choking, never taking its eyes from my window. The breathing continued. I slipped in and out of sleep, half dozing. I dreamt of the seemingly endless tunnels below the cottage, of the pale shapes of the mist and milky-eyed drunks outside my window. I was awoken by something that changed everything. A voice on a tannoy, loud and filtered through static. Remnants from the Blitz, our town still had emergency broadcast systems in place, tested still once a year. I strained to listen to the voice. I recognized the soft accent and slight lisp from somewhere, and in my dazed state, I couldn't place it until I knew exactly where it was from. It was my voice. Playing from every tannoy speaker on every street in the town was my voice. It was a recording from yesterday. This is an emergency broadcast. Do not panic. All citizens are to lock their doors and gather family and friends in one room. Do not let anyone out of your sight. Stay put. Help is coming. Do not, under any circumstances, leave your location. Do not trust voices from outside, no matter how familiar they sound. Help is coming. This is an emergency broadcast. Most importantly, no matter who is at the door, do not let them in. No matter who is at the door, do not let them in.
Thank you for listening to Just the Terror with Nick Guerra. Make sure to check out True Scary Stories with Edie on Tuesdays. Give it 5 stars. And stay scared, uglies.